Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with jazz musician Philip Topping and Peter Sepsis of the Los Angeles-based Tritone Asylum. We caught up with them from their home base in Southern California to talk about their brand new 2022 CD, The Hideaway Sessions, COVID life, and a lot more. This unique musical outfit has masterfully developed an electroacoustic sound that melds jazz, funk, and music from around the world, reflecting their varied musical landscapes of the sounds and street rhythms of Los Angeles. Dig this story.
Well, hey, gentlemen, thank you for taking a minute out. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no worries. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. So, the Hideaway Sessions, you know, it's coming out during kind of the tail end of this pandemic that's rearranged everybody for the last 2 years, and I'm curious the timing of this release. How significant is this and the prospects of possibly being able to do live music and to really get out and promote this in earnest?
Well, that was key to Phil and I. It was in conversations with the record label, Blue Canoe Records. We wanted to be quite timely about this. We realized the multiple meanings of the Hideaway Sessions, and in part, that was a bit of a play on words, in part because we were all locked down with the pandemic. And given that we were thinking that this curve was going to at some time subside, it looked like this would be a good time to do it, given that the winter was slowly going to find its way out and perhaps that this would taper off, hopefully permanently, but you never know. A lot of people are done with the pandemic, but I don't know if it's done with us. And so this seemed to be a pretty decent time to place the release. Phil, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we talked to the label about timing of the release and of course the issue of the pandemic kind of featured in with that. Like, you know, we can't release this in the middle of winter, you know, because things might get worse, you know. Yeah, so that was one of the concerns. And, you know, actually, a lot of the album was done right before the pandemic hit, you know. You know, we kind of waited for a while to release it because, you know, we didn't know what was going to happen. So, yeah, we've been waiting to release this in all actuality, you know. Would you say that's right, Peter?
I mean, I think it's correct. Yeah. I think we waited it out, Joe. We waited it out more than we would like to think, really, because the pandemic had been so devastating. And so I clearly remember a lot of those sessions happening prior to the major hit of COVID-19, and then having to work through a lot of mixing and mastering process during that, and then just kind of lining up our ducks to see when it would be the best time to push this forward. And as you say, there may be a bit of light at the end of the tunnel. There may be opportunities for all of us to get out there on the road again.
So what are you ultimately hoping the listener gets from this experience? What do you want them to get from this project?
I think one of the things, you know, as far as our band from a writing perspective, I mean, maybe Peter has another facet to add to this, but I think for us, it's always important to make music that is enjoyable for both the listener, you know, and is enjoyable by musicians. You know, we've always wanted to have a certain amount of, accessibility by the listener, but we also want to be music that musicians would like, you know, too. So we've tried to ride that line, you know. I think hopefully we've done that successfully, you know. All the musicians, you know, that play in the band really, really like to play in the band, you know. They feel they can musically express themselves. They feel the, you know, at least this is what they tell us, you know. You know, right, yeah. You know, what would we like to believe? So they really love this project. They feel like, you know, it is something unique and they can express themselves. But, you know, we didn't want to make it, you know, too intellectual either, where, you know, only a jazz head could understand it. You know, we want to make it accessible, you know, also to all listeners, you know, because sometimes if things get very esoteric, it can be hard for just the regular listener to find it accessible, you know.
So talk to me a little bit about how you guys came about. How did this union, how did the creative juices get together? How did this start for you?
You could take it from the start, Phil. You were there from the beginning.
Yeah. So I had to end. I had an injury on trumpet. I used to be a trumpeter. I still play some trumpet. I don't really perform professionally on it anymore. And I had an injury, and this would have been in, like 2009, 2008, right around there. And I had stopped playing for a while. And, I picked up the EVI and, started to learn that. And I really liked Pat Metheny with the, his synth work. And, that stuff wasn't always very trumpet-esque. So I never really performed any of his music. And I liked a lot of ECM artists. And so I was like, I want to form a group with this, with this instrument. And, since I'm not playing trumpet right now, I want to try to, form a group with it in the front line as as an instrument. I'm not just the added instrument like that, someone picks up and plays, and then goes back to like sax or trumpet, like a wind controller. A lot of people will do it, but I want to make it figure out how to, make it be part of a jazz group. And so that was the kind of thing I had in my mind. And I had met the guitar player, Andy, and we'd done some playing together here and there a couple times. I was like, man, that's the guitar player I'd like to play with. And so I was looking to form this group. And then I met Peter and another piano player. And Peter and I, really had very similar musical tastes. We both liked Messini. We both liked Herbie Hancock. We had a lot of, similar interests. And we agreed to form the group together. And, it's had some personal changes along the way as all groups develop. But I think, Andy has stuck with us the whole way, and our drummer Dave came on very close to the beginning. And I think we've settled on, the lineup that's the best for us. I don't know, Peter, you probably have something to add to that.
No, I think that makes sense. That's pretty much the history, Joe. That's a very accurate history, Phil.
Beautiful. Well, let's kind of get to the heart and the emotion of what you do as musicians. Talk to me a little bit respectively from each of you how the jaws of jazz actually sank into you and how you got into it and, maybe your first live jazz show or experience album that really influenced you.
Yeah, I mean, it's been an interesting journey to the type of music that I play now. because when I was a kid, probably one of the first live jazz concerts I saw was Maynard Ferguson, and I was more into big band when I was in high school. And then when I got to college, I got more into combo, small group jazz. And, and I figured out that was, really what I wanted to focus on and, develop there. And, but I also always had an interest in fusion, but trumpet and fusion doesn't always go together. I don't know if you noticed that, but most fusion involves saxophones. More saxophone players play fusion than trumpet. At least that's my way I see it. But I always had that interest, but I never got into it. Never had a chance to get really into the band. I became very active in the retro swing music movement that happened in the it started in the early 90s. It didn't really become publicly conscious for most people until the mid-late 90s. And I was in a fairly successful band. We, recorded an album, did some touring and did a lot of stuff, and that band moved to L.A. And, as that scene kind of, petered out, I started working professionally down here, and then all the way up to the period of my injury. And then once that injury happened, and I started playing the EVI, I started, gravitating to all this music that I really didn't tackle on the trumpet, like Messini, because the instrument, really spoke to that, things like Icarus, like Ralph Towner. I mean, it was just stuff that I couldn't translate the trumpet in that. It was never an opportunity in a group to do that. But here with the EVI, I was able to like do that, And I went to some musical areas I always loved to listen to, but really didn't play a lot. And then I translated those to EDI, I mean, obviously on trumpet, Lee Morgan was probably one of my favorite trumpet players. Obviously I'm a Miles fan, I like Freddie, a lot too. You know, I could name a bunch of names there.
And it's always interesting. I always find it very interesting. Right before the pandemic began, I moved into a new house in January. And I moved to the hometown of Pat Metheny. And every time I hear Pat Metheny, it's like when you get a new car and you notice everybody that has the same kind of car as you. I've heard so many Pat Metheny stories, it's unreal.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, like my stepdaughter is, she just got into acting this year. So she did Fiddler on the Roof the other night. And I just kept thinking, what locker? Because it was the same high school as Pat. I'm like, was he in this orchestra pit? Was this his locker? You know, my brain's just going through all of it.
Because
there's such a lore. And they just wrote a book. Carolyn Glenn Brewer is a local author. And she's kind of a trailblazer and like digging up the history of like artifacts Kansas City wise. Like, you know, there was a Kansas City Jazz Women's Fest that was headed up by Mary McPartland back in the 70s, and it was awesome, and it was big here. And anyway, she dug up and did research because her brother was really good friends with Pat, so she's always known the Metheny's. And Mike is a flugelhorn player.
Yeah,
and
I know of Mike. Yeah, he plays a lot of EVI, by the way. So I knew for that. Mm-hmm.
Totally. Yeah. And that's the good thing about living in Kansas City is that I'll find those old albums on vinyl and it's awesome. And sometimes I'm like, I had no idea that his sound went there. You know, he's a trailblazer. But anyway, she wrote a book about his early days before he took off to New York, and the amount of activity that went on with him was unreal. Like, I mean, he played everywhere with everybody. He was just like the ultimate octopus with every tentacle moving, you know?
Right.
But anyway, so talk to me a little bit about being out in Los Angeles. I'm always curious for scenes, since I've kind of given a backdrop to Kansas City. How is the LA scene? How does it treat you guys? How do you survive and thrive with what you're doing with this project out there?
So I can start with that, and let me know if you want to backtrack at all, Joe, in terms of my musical influence. I'd be glad to do that, but if you want to move on to this question, then
No. I was actually hoping that you would finish that answer up, and then we can move on to kind of the LA scene. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So for me, music was always quite big in my house. I mean, I remember Benny Goodman and Duke being played on those really old, Joe, I don't know if you know this. I mean, I'm the oldest guy in this group, okay? But I remember in my living room in San Carlos, California, my parents had this piece of furniture that was actually a stereo, right? You lifted up the top, and there was this kind of rudimentary, as it was at that time, stereo system, and there was always Duke and Benny playing that. And when my older sisters came home, with one of the Supremes albums, I think it was, it might have been a Temps album. My mom was always interested in what they were bringing home, and so she put one of those on and basically heard the rhythms and looked at me and said, "Can you feel this?" And that's when I was so struck by, first of all, the rhythmic aspect of music that I really gravitated towards. Even though I started out as a guitar player, I gravitated towards the bass. And as I grew older, once I started, you know, going through the Motown artists and, of course, the English groups, but when I first got a hold of Steely Dan, that's when everything changed to me. And I remember listening to Asia for the first time and listening to Wayne Shorter and Carl and Lee Rittenhour and Steve Gadd and all those guys on that album. That's when the world of jazz really opened up to me, and I went backwards and forwards from there. I went back into to Miles and Coltrane, and then into Weather Report and Chick Corea and Pat Metheny from there. And it was always the rhythm sections that got me really moving inside, and so I gravitated towards the bass. I moved to the Bay Area, back to the Bay Area at some point, and did work with a lot of different bands who were stylistically diverse, moved to L.A., met Phil, and that's the story there for me, anyway. So it all really started out back in San Carlos, California, with that old piece of furniture that had a stereo in it, and my mom's encouragement, actually. And then to your next question, Joe, about the Los Angeles scene and I believe how it's treating us, correct? That's a two-pronged question for me. It's probably multiple, actually, but you know, when I think of Los Angeles, I keep thinking about how culturally diverse this place is and how I feel at home here, in part, large part, because of that, because it's such an eclectic mix of people. And they are from all sorts of different parts of the world. They represent all sorts of different countries, and that has always been a big influence on my own musical tastes. And so as you go through that album, you'll hear echoes of a country in Africa and some echoes of Vietnam in there for me. And I've always wanted my music to kind of reflect the sounds of the street here, and because it's really a microcosm of different world cultures. And the music all over the world has certainly made a huge impact on me, apart from the jazz diatribe that I just went on. That was a huge part of my upbringing. And I think that we found a bit of a home here in the Baked Potato. We play there quite frequently. And there have been some other clubs that we play. There was, you mentioned, you were talking about being in Kansas City and Papafini. There's this artistic group here in L.A. called Musique. And during the pandemic, they were shut down. And normally there are lots of public performances. And the music director there had asked us to come up with a very short piece, as they all had to be online at that time. And we came up with Better Days Ahead, and we covered that. And she introduced that at that time, Pat Metheny being born and bred Kansas City, Missouri. Was it Kansas City, Kansas, or was it Missouri?
Missouri, yes.
Yeah. Kansas City, Missouri. And all this to say, we've had great opportunity here in L.A. to showcase our music, and people gravitate to it no matter where they're backdrop is. So I think it's treated us very well at this point in the game. As you mentioned earlier, Joe, the pandemic may be partially subsiding or temporarily subsiding. We'd like to take an opportunity to get our music out there a little bit more broadly and maybe get back on the road and do some work in other marketplaces.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that. I mean, I think the Baked Potato, just to talk about that, you know, it's been very, very important, you know, for us. And I think for a lot of bands like ours, because, you know, it's a place, you know, that will have a lot of different types of music. You know, it's not just a straight ahead place, you know, which is straight ahead jazz. They have a lot of fusion and stuff like that. So I think our musical style has definitely fit in with the Baked Potato very well. You know, Baked Potato, I think now is the oldest surviving jazz club in Los Angeles. I think some of the other ones have went out of business over the years or relocated or, you know, but it's been kind of under the same ownership since 1970. So, and, you know, we fit in there very well. We found that playing there regularly is really where we feel the most at home, you know? And, you know, I mean, John DeVersa had, you know, a monthly gig there for a long time. He plays EVI as well. And, you know, so it's always been a host, you know, the Baked Potato has always been this kind of place that, you know, where a lot of fusion artists have played. And so I think it's natural that that's become our most regular place that we play. And, you know, we played another place we've done some dates, but we play less there now is Vitello's. We used to play there regularly. It's another jazz, you know, they do jazz and some other stuff as well. But we found over time that we like playing the Baked Potato more, so we've kind of stopped playing there, you know. So, but I want to echo what Peter said. We want to get back, we want to go out on the road. We'd like to try to maybe do something on the West Coast and do some other cities. That's really a goal of ours, to try to get out of L.A., you know. And so, it's one of our major goals.
I guess, you know, kind of getting back into the album and promoting and get the world opening back up. What do you two hope that both the musician and the audience realizes about the power of live music when we kind of start returning in earnest?
Yeah, I'm going to take this back to big band, actually, strangely enough. I mean, I know it doesn't have a lot to do with you, although if you look on our YouTube, we do one of our, a big band version of one of our songs. It's not on the album, but, you know, I teach jazz to students, you know, and that's my day gig. I'm the jazz director at Hamilton High School. You know, John DeVersa came out of that school. Kamasi Washington came out of that school. So it's got a long storied history. Just thought I would also make you aware of that. But I'm not just bringing it up just to bring it up. I'm bringing it up because I'm with youth on a daily basis, you know, teaching about jazz. And one thing you know about jazz, about music, especially jazz, it's not fully appreciable until you see it live. And, you know, like big band, you don't understand the power of a big band until you stand in front of it. On recording, it doesn't really translate, especially the older the recording is. Like, if you go back, you know, 60, 70 years and listen to those recordings, like, you know, the Basie band, you know, for those old recordings, when they were, you know, they sound my tone, what, now, you know, really, like, muffled because, you know, recording technology. But, man, if you were in front of that band back then, it's a powerful thing. And even now, if you're in front of a big band, it's, you know, when you're standing in front of a good big band, it will just blow you away. You know what I mean by that? And some of that doesn't translate, you know, on recording. And the same thing about improvisation, you know, going, seeing someone create music in the moment, like being there and witnessing it, like in the moment, it's a totally different experience. So I feel like that's part of what's happened with jazz is that jazz, you know, hearing recordings is great, but if you've never seen jazz live and you can't connect it to the feeling of seeing that music created in the moment and you've never experienced that, there's only so much you're going to get off a record, you know. But if you've seen jazz live and then you go listen to a record, then you felt that and you've been there and you can take that feeling and apply it to the recording. You know what I mean? So I think, you know, that's one of the major struggles of jazz in the future. There are a few major struggles. There's probably three I could name, but I'm not going to talk about the three. But the one is that jazz is alive music, and it's about creating, you know, improvising music in the moment, you know, and that's really what it's about. And, you know, a lot of times the recording studio doesn't capture that, and that doesn't always come across over recording. At least that's my opinion, you know. So I think, you know, playing live is at the heart of what we do, and the economics are hard now. I mean, it's cost so much to do a show. You know, and also ticket prices are so high, so people can't just come out and say, oh, let me just go check this out. It's like $20 to get in to see a band, you know? And so it's not something, you know, in a two-drink cover and, you know, all this, you know, it's like, it's something that you have to, like, be willing to shell out some cash for. You can't just say, well, I'm just going to go try this, you know? It's got to be something that you're willing to, like, spend some money on, you know? So I think, you know, some of these things are making jazz, you know, live jazz inaccessible, and it's frustrating. I'm not saying I have the solutions or anything, but to truly understand this music, you have to see it live, period.
I agree. I think that's the fitting epitaph for our world right now, and hopefully that feeling doesn't go away. I totally agree. I mean, I remember so many times that I would have conversations with people about live music. I remember the last show that I went to was March 4th. It was Bill Frisell, and I got married in 2019 and was with my wife for about 3 years and really got her into jazz because I'm a jazz radio guy. And yeah. when we went to that show, she was like, what's this going to be like? And I was like, Bill Frisell, I don't know. I have no idea. Like, no idea what he's going to do. But the significance of that was it was the last show before everything closed down, like the last thing. And we all, at one point, Petra Hayden was singing, and she got everybody to stand up to sing We Shall Overcome. And to prove the eclecticness of the show, the next song was Bowie's Ziggy Stardust, which is why you can't predict what they're going to do. But everybody stood up in unison and swayed and sang the song, and it was eerie. It was like a bunch of animals that knew that some kind of seismic calamity was going to hit Earth. So
yeah,
my point is that as somebody that does radio and gets tickets and passes, I always take a deep breath, close my eyes, and I just pull it in and think, this is amazing, every single time. And I think that's something that hopefully comes back in earnest with everybody, that we're always, always grateful that there's this communal human element that's going to go in to making that energy in a room that's known as music.
Yeah, it's an energy in the room. I agree. It's like, and that's one thing I didn't mention in my diatribe. It's like the performer feeds off the audience, and the audience feeds off the performer. That is like, I mean, it's important in all music, you know what I mean? But it's especially important in jazz, you know? It really is.
So I want to add to that, Phil. I think that's a great, great commentary, and mine's very similar, Joe. For me, it's all about the human connection, and not just what Phil just said, that the connection goes back and forth between the audience and the players and evolves from there. But it's also between the players and among the audience themselves. And for me, the need to connect people to people through this medium is exceedingly important, because there's so many things, pardon my diatribe, there's so many things that we disagree on today, that if I can contribute some little part to getting people in one room to unite around an experience, this being our music, to unite around this experience, it would have been well worth it to me if I can just do that.
So my final question to you is, you know, everyone in, like, that will see you live that gets around you has a perception of who you guys are. But tell me who you guys think you are as a collective, as a band, when you get out there and make music. Just, let's just say you were even coming to Kansas City and you had to write up a notice on social media or in one of our local magazines to pull people in to who you are and what you do. What would you say?
Well, I'm going to start off with a word. We define our band, I mean, we from the beginning defined our band as electroacoustic. And we combine, you know, the EVI's, you know, mainly an electric wind instrument, but it's got some, even though it's not acoustic, it's also got some breath control, some things that a keyboard does. We have an acoustic saxophone, you know, we blend with a guitar. If we have a real piano, we will use it. You know, we use Rhodes, we use, you know, which is, it's electric, but it's it rides the line. It actually, something vibrates in there and makes a sound for real at one point. It's not like a synthesizer. Yeah. So we kind of came up with the word electroacoustic in our sound. We're kind of blending those two sounds together, you know? And, you know, I think stylistically, you know, we draw on jazz, you know, funk music, and world music and fusion. I think those are our main styles. And we're trying to an eclectic blend of different, you know, styles. You know, we're not just totally a straight ahead jazz group, obviously, you know. And we really, you know, like I said before, we're trying to make music that's approachable for the general person, but that's not necessarily pop music, you know what I mean? But we're also trying to make music that's approachable to musicians, you know, and we really feel like we have our own sound. I guess, you know, I don't know, maybe Peter can answer a little better, but that's some of the things that run through my mind about our band, you know?
No, I think that's great, Phil. I also would add this. To me, I would hope that coming to our show would be an invitation to join an experience. And the experience to me is the backdrop of every one of those songs, Joe. Every one of them has a story. And they have deep meaning to us. I mean, Phil and I are the writers. So far we've been the writers. And each one of those songs has a backdrop. And I'd want them to experience that backdrop in a place like Kansas City that might not be, I haven't been there in a while, as diverse as Los Angeles, probably one of the most diverse cities in the world. I want that invitation to experience that diversity wherever we go, through sound, and to take part in that asylum experience, because I don't think anybody else can deliver that experience like we can.
Yeah, we're a unique group, and let me add one thing. I do believe we're a unique group, and let me just make one pitch on the player side of things, you know. I really believe that we have a lot of players, and some of them aren't like household names, you know, or in the jazz world. but I really believe that we have some individual voices in this group. I mean, like Andy, I mentioned at the beginning, Andy Waddell, the guitar player, I mentioned at the beginning, like when I first heard him, I was like, I heard something there, you know? I mean, there is no other guitar player I've ever played. I think he has an individual voice on his own. You know what I mean? You know, Mitch Foreman, I mean, he's more of a name that's known. You know, he is an artist in his own right. You know what I mean? He's got his own sound going on, and it's compatible with what we do. And I think that's why he agreed to join the group. You know, because it was in line with a lot of his musical tastes. And he's been with us for a long time now. You know, and Ian Vo, the saxophone player. I met Ian Vo when I went to Cal Arts, and you know, he's a great player. He's not somebody that, you know, everybody's heard his name before, but he is a fabulous tenor player with his own sound, you know? And so, you know, and so every musician in this group and, you know, that me and Peter are playing with, we feel like we've assembled some musicians that have unique voices, you know, and want to play our music and interpret our compositions. So that's how we feel about it. You know, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that's what I believe, you know?
No, so, I think it's true, Phil. I do. You know? I think it's Phil, and I'm sorry to I might have interrupted you there.
No, it's okay.
Okay, so I think that Phil's spot on with this, Joe. I think that these guys that play with us come to play with us for a reason, because it is extremely enjoyable. Number two, they like the music, and number two, they have free rein to go, to quote unquote move about the cabin. It's kind of like, go ahead, Andy. Go ahead, Ian. Go ahead, Phil. Go ahead, Mitch. Go ahead, everybody. Go ahead.
Yeah, we don't tell them how to play. You know, it's not like we're like, we want you to play this style, we want you to play that. I mean, they get that in bands. They play it all the time. You know, they come play with us because we give them the material and allow them, you know, the freedom to explore it how they choose.
And that's the cool thing, Joe, because it's a collective interpretation then, right? It's kind of like, we get into a room, here's the sheet, let's see where this goes. Phil and I don't have any direction apart from the overall form, right? And even that may change. I mean, we've been in sessions, recording sessions. Grasshopper was one of those instances where, oh, yeah, we're going to add this ending. Okay, well, I hadn't thought of that. It wasn't on the chart. Let's do that. You know, it happens in shows. It happens all the time. And so I think that for me, when I look at this band, I kind of look at this as, hey, what a great linkage, what a community, if you will, that allows each other this degree of acceptance and the degree to which people are not selfish. You know?
And trust, you know, musical trust. And we just trust,
yeah,
that,
totally.
Trust that everybody's ideas, you know, are going to work and are valid, and we're not going to mess with it too much, you know.
No, not with these guys, and not with the relationships that we've built, Joe. This has been kind of a bit of a collective family, if you will. And granted, these guys have all sorts of different groups that they're working with, but to a T, it's kind of like, yeah, the Asylum's at the top of the list.
Beautiful, man. I love that answer. Hey, guys, thank you for opening up. Thanks for giving us a little bit of a portal into your creative process. Good luck with the album and, you know, the return to the stage as we move forward.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in Los Angeles, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to both Philip and Peter for their time, music, and stories. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com. And for everything Neon Jazz all the time, go to the neonjazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.